Today's book offers a practical blueprint for thinking and acting in environments that are fast-paced, rapidly changing, and highly uncertain. It provides both a guide to energizing the organization to find tomorrow's opportunities and a set of entrepreneurial principles you can use personally to transform the arenas in which you compete. Our guest presents simple but powerful ways to stop thinking and acting by the old rules and start thinking with the discipline of a habitual entrepreneur. This book is an absolute playbook for how to not only start an organization, not only to run a startup, but to select the ideas in the first place so you're not wasting your time, and in an organization to select and kill those ideas very intelligently. It's a masterpiece of a book, and today is the first in a series with one of my favorite people in innovation. I have the great pleasure to have met her on a couple of occasions, recorded in person over the years, and she's a friend of the show and a brilliant thinker. And it's a pleasure to bring you the author of The Entrepreneurial Mindset, Rita McGrath. You're very welcome.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Many people won't know that you worked in industry before you went into academia, and you have that scar tissue of what it's like. And that helped you then spark a career that has spanned and helped so many organizations, many of which you mention in this book.
My undergraduate degree is in political science, and I did a master's in public policy. And I thought I was going to become a public policy, politics kind of person, and started two little businesses right out of my graduate program. And the first one was, I'd love to glamorously call it a political consulting business. It really was. It did the dirty underbelly gut work of politics, which is direct voter campaigns. And for example, in New York City, there's the primary vote, which is only people from your party. And then there's the general election where anybody can vote. Well, in New York City, it's heavily Democratic. So what you would do is you would go to the courthouses and pick up lists of people who were likely to vote in primaries and then target your mailings towards them. And so we did a lot of that back office work. And it did really well. And we made the kind of classic mistake, though, that you make when you're in your early 20s and you start a business. We forgot elections don't happen every year. Yeah. And so then year two, sitting there going, well, where is everybody? And so then the business morphed into a second business, which was, we called it Unworried Words. And back in the day, this was the sort of 24-hour typing, copying, word processing kind of thing, you know, dotted around college campuses. That was the idea. And again, those were very successful businesses back in the day. And then we had this moment of truth where someone offered us a $100,000 loan to scale it. And I just froze. I spent a horrible weekend, sort of dark night of the soul stuff. And I realized I got into this to do the politics, not to do the typing and word processing stuff. So I ended up transferring my, sold my part of the business to my partner. And then I went into government. So I spent a chunk of time doing what we today would call digital transformation. We didn't know that term back then. We called it computerization. And it was taking manual processes and systems and basically, you know, transforming them by making them digital. And that went on for a whole chunk of time. And then the thing about public service, which is fascinating to me, is your career goes like this for the first chunk of time, and then it just goes like that for the rest of your life. And I got to this turning point and I thought, well, is there a way I could perhaps have a bigger impact? And my husband and I were talking it over, and he said, well, why don't you apply to business school? At the time, business schools were a booming industry. As finance got to be more important in the economies, so too did business schools. And the universities were under a lot of pressure to put people with PhDs in front of the class rather than tired guys that sold tires or something. And it was becoming a really popular degree. So my husband basically said, look, if you get into a top five school, it's worth doing. If you don't, it's not. And so I got into Wharton, which is based in Philadelphia, and I commuted south and he commuted north. And that's how we got through our PhD. And then when I graduated, I took a role at Columbia. So that was the journey to there.
Wow. Wow. And I had the great pleasure of meeting your husband, John, as well. On one of those occasions, I met you, and he was telling me, the way I pictured this was, he's telling me, like, you should see the amount of stuff Rita's written. Like, it's amazing. And I was thinking about these movies where there's like a hidden vault. And I was like, I'm sure there's a vault in the McGrath household somewhere. There is.
right downstairs. Well, it's not so much a vault as it is a bunch of rather large, well, I guess you call them metal shelves with all my PhD materials. And yeah, there's a lot of that still there.
Wow. And the reason I mentioned that is because even before you wrote this book, The Entrepreneurial Mindset, many articles had appeared. And I just wanted to share maybe some of those because you'd written many articles for HBR, for example.
One of the first was Discovery-Driven Planning, which was written in 1995. It's quite interesting. It's from the perspective of your show, because that was also the same year Clay's article came out with Joe Bauer. Everybody's forgotten that Joe was involved in this, but Joe Bauer was one of the first academics to really lean into this idea that the fundamental strategic process in corporations is the resource allocation process. And he looked at everything through a resource allocation view. And he and Clay wrote the original Disruptive Technologies piece that came out that same year. And Clay and I had very interesting kind of parallel careers. He fell in love with discovery-driven planning. I fell in love with disruptive innovation. So we had many conversations over many years, and our careers went together in parallel in a lot of ways. So that was one. Then I wrote an article about a concept I call the consumption chain, which basically says you think about your customer from the moment that they first become aware that they might have a need for something you might be able to provide them, all the way through to the moment that need is satisfied or they renew their contract or whatever. There's all these sets of experiences. And very often companies have these incredible blind spots when it comes to the complete chain of consumption that a customer goes through. And that can, anytime the chain breaks or something stops and a customer doesn't move through, that's, you could lose them. That's the possibility of a sale ending. We also wrote about, and when I say we, I'm talking about myself and my co-author, Ian McMillan. We wrote an article called Attribute Mapping about discovering new points of differentiation. And there, what we said is, don't think that every customer segment that you serve feels the same way about what you're offering. There are always going to be positives. There are always going to be things they don't like. There are always going to be things they could care less about. And so you need to understand that. And so if you put those two ideas together, at each link in the consumption chain, there's a corresponding attribute map. And you can really parse your offer into what those dimensions are.
Absolutely loved all those concepts, and they're all in this book as well, so you don't have to go and find each of those articles, which you can do, but they're all in this book, including many diagrams. I hope that some of which we'll share throughout the series as well, Rita. One last thing, because you mentioned Joe Bauer, and funnily, coincidentally, I love the coincidences that happen when you do a podcast, as from your own podcast, is I just emailed Joe Bauer because we're doing a series. We had him on for that Clay Christensen tribute that you partook in, but also Joe did, and I call it the Hour of Bauer, but we're doing a series called The Hours of Bauer, and it's going to cover all his book, because I think that concept of resource allocation, which you mentioned in this book as well, is so valuable, and you touch on that later in the book as well. I'd love to pull at that string as well, because it's such an important aspect, even as the entrepreneur with inside an organization trying to sell that idea. But that serves as a perfect segue. We're still on the history here, because you do touch on the history at the start of this book, and you talk about the theories of strategic management under uncertainty. Great title. And I have a little quote here that I'd love you to expand upon. You wrote, "Problems of planning and leading under uncertain conditions are pervasive in the life of any manager, but have not always been central to the theory of strategic management. Neoclassical economists finesse the issue of disruptive change by focusing on seeking the conditions under which equilibrium will emerge. Drawing from the neoclassical tradition, strategic management scholars in the 40s and 50s tried to identify the regular patterns that would be amenable to predictive theorizing." And this is the one, an early and still useful framework that you talk about in the book that adopted this approach was known as the structure conduct performance paradigm. A great term. Maybe you'll share a little bit about this.
Yeah, well, that's a very traditional way of explaining corporate performance. And I think it goes all the way back to many books that were elaborating on that. And what it basically argued was that the performance of a firm will be related to the structure of the economic conditions in which it finds itself, and accordingly then how it behaves. And it was a very important idea to the theory of monopoly. And so back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, a big preoccupation among many scholars was, how do you deal with monopolistic competition? So if you go back to the the big oil companies or the big electricity providers or whatever. These are so-called natural monopolies because they require economies of scale. You have to be a certain size to be able to deliver what you're delivering efficiently and effectively. And if you were a smaller scale player, you couldn't really compete. And so it produced incredible entry barriers. So there was all this work done on, well, how should these things be regulated? And economists were weighing in on one thing and another. And interestingly, Michael Porter, who's, of course, Five Forces Framework became a mainstay in strategy, he took that whole paradigm and flipped it on his head. And he said, wait a minute, what are the conditions under which a firm can deliberately create semi-monopolistic conditions? And that was the basis of his Five Forces model. So I think that structure, conduct, performance idea was that very positional idea, right? Which was that in a certain set of economic structures, if a firm behaves in such a way, good or bad results won't occur.
Thanks for humoring me with this trip down memory lane as well, because a lot of the stuff I never had heard of, I haven't got this foundation, and I'm sure that's the case for the majority of people listening to the show. Later, you talk about pioneering economists Richard Nelson and Sidney Winter, who introduced the idea of evolutionary economics in 1982, and you tell us among their insights was the idea that firms develop valuable path-dependent routines, but that these are difficult to change. I love this because you say here, uncertainty thus presents a major challenge to such theories.
Yeah, so what Nelson and Winter did, which was absolutely brilliant, was they developed a concept of an organizational routine. And a routine you can think of as a process or a pattern or something that gets repeated and reinforced over time. So as an example, right, we all in this day and age probably have some relationship to touch typing, right? And so the routines that we've built have to do with how we digitally interact with the devices around us. Now, here's what's interesting with the idea of a routine, which is a predictable, repeatable set of activities that produces an outcome. So what Nelson and Winter argue is that routines evolve, but they evolve in a path-dependent way, meaning what I'm going to be doing 6 months from now is going to be related somehow to what I'm investing in learning to do today, right? So it's a kind of very intuitive idea on the one hand, but on the other, it was something that had never been talked about in economics. Or economics always assumes you start with a blank sheet of paper and go from there. But they also identified, and this came up later also in the work of June March, a thing called a competence trap. And a competence trap is a fascinating thing from the perspective of disruptive innovation, because what a competence trap does is it recognizes that when you introduce a new pattern or a new technology into a firm, to use it to benefit from it, you have to develop routines around it. So I'll just take typing as an example. So you introduce touch typing into a firm, and all of us eventually, at some level of skill or not, develop a relationship with touch typing. And to do that, right, we have to internalize the way keyboards are laid out. So you've got the QWERTY, the QWERTY keyboard. Well, we know from many years of research that QWERTY keyboard is actually really inefficient. And people have forgotten now, but back in the day when typewriters were first invented, they consisted of mechanical arms that would create the letters. And a really fast typist would inadvertently jam the arms. And so this engineer developed the QWERTY keyboard specifically to slow typing down so that the arms wouldn't jam. But we've all had developed this relationship with the QWERTY keyboard where that's the way we've developed skill at it. We're comfortable with it. And we know that if there's other keyboard layouts that if we took the time to retrain ourselves, we would be much more efficient over the long run. And yet the QWERTY keyboard persists even on phones today where you're not even doing touch typing anymore. But that's the keyboard layout. So that's an example of a competence trap. It means you develop a level of capability at something which provides a disincentive for you to adopt a new technology or a new capability, even if it would in the long run deliver much better results.
I have to admit, Rita, I used to purposely jam my dad's typewriter back in the day as well. It was like, that was fun, jamming the typewriter. But just like you say, because we'll pick this up later on in the series as well, because you talk about that later on. When you're looking at potential markets, you need to actually look at that. Is there some type of competence trap there that will make it very difficult to change behaviors inside a different market, like bringing in a Dvorak keyboard, for example? I tried, by the way, to do that. I tried to upgrade, but it's so difficult to actually find a keyboard. You can only find the actual keyboard for a QWERTY keyboard. So it's really difficult to change, even if you wanted to. Which all brings us to, well, there's a need for a new mindset. And this is where you introduced the idea of the entrepreneurial mindset. You say the successful future strategists will exploit an entrepreneurial mindset, melding the best of what older models have to tell us with the ability to rapidly sense, act, and mobilize, even under highly uncertain conditions. And when you wrote that, things have got even more uncertain since you wrote that book as well. But this tees us up to look at what is the entrepreneurial mindset. Maybe you'll share what you meant by this when you wrote it.
Well, the entrepreneurial mindset was inspired partly by our studies of habitual entrepreneurs. So part of the trouble with studying entrepreneurship is anybody can get lucky, right? And be in the right place at the right time. And even if you're not particularly skilled, if Lady Luck smiles upon you, that's terrific. But a lot of ink has been wasted studying what I'll call lucky entrepreneurs, people who just happen to be at the right place at the right time. So my colleague and I said, well, what if we were to study people who've done over and over and over, they started a business, they've scaled it, they've sold it or whatever, and then they go start something else. What practices do they look at? And so what we found was a number of quite distinctive things. So continuously searching for new ideas. So they have almost, I think in the book, we called it an idea inventory. You know, there's a continuous flow of things that they've got. And they then go through very simple practices of validating whether there's actually demand for those ideas. So continuous flow of new ideas, continuous validation. When they see that there's an economic case, they can move it quickly and put in place mechanisms to begin to capitalize on that idea. They are absolutely skilled and adroit networkers. They have these vast networks of weak ties, again, which helps them with the idea part, but it also helps them with pulling in other kinds of resources. And then when it comes time to make decisions, they're very good at stopping things because they've got hundreds of ideas. So it doesn't really matter if one of them goes forward or not. They've got many more to look choose from. And they're also very good at decisively mobilizing resources when they think the time is right. So there's these practices. And then that got us thinking, well, if you think about a corporation, the idea behind a corporation is it should be able to outlive the career of any particular leader in it, right? That's why we have them. So, and back to Nelson Winter, right? These corporations have incredibly valuable capabilities and routines and things that they do uniquely well. So we were thinking, well, what if you draw from the playbook of the entrepreneur who's habitual, who's done many startups, and then applied that to what a corporation would need to do. And that was the genesis of the book.
In that chapter, you talked about, for example, the characteristics of these habitual entrepreneurs. And one of the ones that is often missed, particularly in today's corporate innovation, particularly when it comes to innovation theater, is the discipline that's involved. And this is one of the things that I love throughout your work is this is tough work. When you launch onto this, if you're to do it right, and if you're to actually hone down, look at what opportunities are there, what's worth going after? What will you pursue? Also, how much time you need to assign to this? And Rita even goes into all this later on in the book about assigning time, corporate time to people. This is resource allocation. But how much time you will need in order to pursue a certain portfolio of opportunities as well? This is a lot of Excel work. There's a lot of work in this. And the good news is, I have to tell you now, Rita has software with her company Valise that will actually do this for you. So we'll touch on that later and I'll share the links to Valise software as well. So this tees us up beautifully for chapter two, which is framing the challenge. And this is creating the entrepreneurial frame. This is absolutely core to the book. Rita tells us here, the basic objective is to define in advance the criteria that would make a business opportunity worthwhile for you to pursue. The way to do this is to articulate challenging objectives for how much value an opportunity should add to your piece of the business. The idea is to improve not only profits, but profitability as well. Your goal should be, in other words, to get into businesses with ever better margins and profits than those that you were in today. The trick, you tell us, is to come up with realistic yet challenging targets. What you are after is not just the probable, but a stretch to the probable. Maybe you'll tell us about the first objective in creating an entrepreneurial mindset, which is to make sure that you have clearly established what your business needs to do to make the efforts worthwhile.
That's a fascinating starting point, right? Because when you go into a business and you say, well, what does success look like? A lot of times you get back this blank stare. People are running around doing all this work and they don't even know what would good look like if they were successful. It's like getting in a car and driving aimlessly around without knowing what your destination is. So one of the things we try to get people to really think about and to align on at a senior level, and I echo this again in discovery-driven growth where I get very specific about it, but to align at a senior level on what are our ambitions? What's our growth gap? In other words, what does the business need to be able to do in the future? Recognizing that your existing business of today is likely to experience either flat growth or to fade over time as competition catches up and you reach diminishing returns and so you have that wave of competitive advantage that comes and goes. So you need something new to replace it. And the inspiration for this chapter was really, let's align as a senior team and let's do that first. Because otherwise, as you're running your corporate governance process, if you don't clearly define what criteria would make something more or less attractive, now you get into, well, whose pet project is that? And who's the most enthusiastic advocate? And, oh, we said we were going to Brazil. Argentina looks pretty good. And you just end up with this mess, right? So the idea was to take the discipline, and this is not easy. This is why companies don't do it. To take the discipline of having the senior team align on what does good look like and for what part of the business? And what are the goals of the different parts of the business?
As you say, nobody wants to do that because that's really tough work. And it's not the fuzzy, happy work of innovation. You told me before the term, was it imagination land that everybody wants to live in?
Oh, yeah, thought land.
Thought land.
Thought land. They want to live in thought land. Thought land's fun. Thought lands are great. Thought land's full of bean bags and there's snacks in the fridge and cool stuff on the walls and an unlimited supply of post-it notes. Thought land is great.
And it's actually where many people in innovation live. And the concept of people taking a job in innovation, and this is one of the big problems, isn't it, Rita, where people who go into the role think that's it. And then people who work in the organization, who are working on the organization today, think that these guys are squandering resources by doing that.
Well, in many cases, they are, right? We've just come off a period of just pervasive innovation theater. And if you go back to, 2017, 2018, there were all these accelerators and studios and announcements about, oh, our big innovation hub is blah, 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 blah. And it was all that front end, right? It was all thoughtland stuff. It didn't really have an impact on the organization. And so the first whiff of, you know, major economic dislocation comes along. 2022, we have the war in Ukraine. We have inflation starting to rear its head. And all that stuff gets shut down. And the code word for this is the year of efficiency or back to basics or we're going to return to the core. And all that crazy innovation stuff just gets slashed. And the point is they didn't really mean it to begin with. It was all just windows.
But Rita's work, if you're a leader of an organization, if you're a board member of an organization, if you're an entrepreneur looking to start a business, gives you a playbook of how to do it. And this idea of the entrepreneurial frame is a specific measurable challenge to enhance the value of your piece of the business. The frame provides focus and creates a sense of urgency for you and those who work with you. The entrepreneurial frame has two components, Rita. I'd love you to take us through them. The first is, you tell us you should be clear on the minimum amount of additional profits you need from a new venture. And second, you need to specify what increase in profitability your new opportunity needs to achieve as well.
Yeah. So the idea is if you're going to undertake the risk of doing something new, it should do better, right, than the existing business. And so let's say your business is a $2 billion business. Well, to really be of interest, a new business has to have the capability of being at least, let's say, a $200 million business. And if your existing business is returning you 10% returns, let's say, then your new business should be able to deliver better than that because the new businesses are where all the incremental increase in profitability is going to come from. And in fact, there's some great research that was done on this, looking at the returns over time to innovations. And what these researchers found, they were working with Monitor at the time, was that the classic allocation of resources, right? It should be 70% to the core, 20% to some kind of extension of the core, and then 10% perhaps to these disruptive, far out kind of innovations. And what they found out when you look at return on investment was the return is exactly inverse. So that every dollar, pound, or euro that you put into these more radical innovations returned 90%. returned 70%. The adjacencies were 20% and the core was like 10%. So you need to be, if you're really moving your organization toward the future, it's almost like you think about it as creating new fields, right? Even as the old ones might start to fade. And that's something that I think leaders don't talk about enough. So There's a fascinating concept called the Parmenides fallacy, which I don't know if I mentioned in that book or not, but I have written about it later, which is the tendency when we're making a decision is we compare where we are today to some uncertain future. So I'm going to ask you to put 500,000 euro into an innovation fund, and you look at me and you go, well, you know, what is that going to return me? And that's a big risk. And I could put that same 500,000 into the core business, and this is what I'd get. Well, that's the Parmenides fallacy. You're comparing where you are today with some uncertain future. The right comparison is if I make choice A, this is what the future looks like. If I make choice B or I do nothing, that's what the future looks like. So let's compare future states to future states. And that's the mindset I'm encouraging people bring to this framing challenge.
So just to show you the discipline of this and how, as the entrepreneur or the corporate entrepreneur, corporate explorer, corporate entrepreneur who is running a program, how you need to work with finance, how you need to actually present this with finance, even to look at yourself, is it worth going after these ideas? Because I've been there, Rita, and you can fall in love with the idea because it's a nice idea and it might look shiny and new, etc. And this is one of the big problems, but you actually show us how to kill the idea or not even pursue it in the first place. And this diagram, for those who are joining us on YouTube, you'll be able to see exactly what we're talking about here. Rita shares in the book a worksheet of making the entrepreneurial frame specific. Maybe you'll take us through this because this shows you the detail that's required.
Yeah, so this is just a simple articulation of what a spreadsheet you could create was like. And we were trying to make it really practical. So you see, to take last year's profits, right? And last year's return on sales. And then by extrapolating, right, you work backward into what would the new business need to generate in terms of profits to generate an increase in profitability. And then what do you think it's going to look like in terms of assets based on what you know about the existing business? So it's just really working backwards. That's the key concept, which is I know what I'd like to achieve in the future. If I work backwards to today, what does that imply for action today?
Once you've decided what to go after, you've done this hard work already, and this is already too much work for many people. I know that myself. I'd be like, oh, this is mind-numbing work, but it's absolutely essential work to do. Next, you have to set up an opportunity register. And this is the next step in the entrepreneurial frame, where you decide on the format of an opportunity register, the place where we inventory all the entrepreneurial ideas that emerge from applying techniques that you offer in the book. Maybe you'll share this at a high level, Rita.
Yeah. So the idea behind an opportunity register or an opportunity inventory is back to this notion of the habitual entrepreneur. Right? What you don't want is to have one big idea that everybody gets so invested in that it's a complete disaster if it doesn't work. What you want is a whole bank of ideas and lots of them. And as in innovation, it's a numbers game, right? Out of 100 ideas, maybe two or three are going to really be the ones that pay off for the whole portfolio. And then there'll be a whole bunch that are in the middle range, and then a whole bunch that are never going to see the light of day. So the more ideas that you have, the better as a general. And the more you can keep them alive, right? Because some ideas are great, but they're just not ready yet. The ecosystem isn't ripe yet, or the technology isn't yet at the right stage. Some ideas are just too small, but they may lead to other ideas, you know, that are worth thinking about, you know, in a more constructive way. So what we find when we start to collect these idea inventories is that there are patterns, you know, that you can start to see, for example, certain kinds of technologies beginning to emerge. And one of the fascinating things about technological development is these things, you know, don't evolve the way we often think they do. What happens in many cases is simultaneous discovery. So if you look at anything from medical discovery to calculus or whatever, there are multiple times these things get invented in different places. So what you want to be able to do is keep track of where your organization is with respect to these new things. And then periodically go through them. And you can go through them in terms of opportunity size. You can go through them in terms of technology usage. You can go in terms of geography spread. But the concept is you've got someplace to put them now.
And that's the next step you talk about, is where to place it and the format of the opportunity register. Because if you think about most organizations, it's in somebody's head, or it's in a document that's put away in a desk in Sector 7G, never to be seen again. And maybe you'll share some ideas of where to share this and where to have a living document, or maybe it's on a wall somewhere, etc.
Well, here's the thing. There's a ton of software that will help you generate and sort ideas. So there are a number of really great brands that help you do that. Vote them, downvote them, run a hackathon, do all this stuff. And that's great. And I think the more that you can have it transparently captured, back when you wrote Entrepreneurial Mindset, technology wasn't nearly as developed as it is today. But today, it would be child to have a common database. And there are a lot of technologies you can use today. So technologies like Trello or, you know, Asana or Jira boards, they can also be put to this purpose, right? Now, what I found, though, and one of the reasons that I did develop this software that we can talk about at some stage, was there's all this stuff that helps you catalog and capture ideas. And then what? And that's where it then goes into individual spreadsheets or individual work groups. And God forbid a senior leader says, what's the current status of our portfolio? Some poor intern is out there 24/7 running from desk to desk virtually saying, what's the status of this latest thing? So what we decided was a gap, was a software program that would allow you to track what's in your portfolio, see how uncertain it is, see what you're learning, see how it's evolving, that kind of problem. And so that's what we built. So it's in between the discovery of the idea to the actual scaling. Because when you want to scale, you need something. But in between, there really wasn't anything. So that's why we built the software called Spark Hub to deal with it. So the way I would do it today is different, has evolved from the book, because technology has come so much farther.
Yeah. And as you say in the book, just to show people, you were talking about like databases there. You were talking about index cards, for example, people would scan on a regular basis throughout the organization. But one of the things I think that a product like SparkUp does is it actually removes the ownership, the not invented here syndrome, because it becomes just an input into this document. Might have an originator, but that originator probably move on. And that's one of the things I'd love you to share, is just how that actually happens, where it might be too soon, the technology might not be ripe, etc.
Well, so trying to think of a good example. So let's take autonomous cars just as a case in point, right? So humankind has collectively spent something like $100 billion on autonomous cars and have discovered that it's a lot harder than we thought, I think, is the lesson. But out of that set of investments are a series of things that we can begin to bring to market right now. So for example, in the military, the robots aren't smart enough to take over a lot of the transport needs of military operations. So supplying the front line, for example. But they are smart enough to play follow the leader. So out of the whole autonomous program comes a piece which can be commercialized early. I call these stepping stones. And so now, what you've got now is a front vehicle with human beings inside that say does what only human beings can do. But now you could use autonomous technology to daisy chain other vehicles behind them. So that's an opportunity that's ready, right? The technology is good enough. There is a clear use case. Somebody will pay you to do it. Autonomy will eventually come in some form. My personal belief is it'll come when we take the humans out of the equation. So right now, what we're trying to do is create autonomous cars that kind of plug into a human-created and very chaotic system of transport and automobiles and everything else. And that's a really hard problem. But if you were to take the humans out of the equation, imagine a world where you didn't have humans driving cars. Well, guess what? You probably wouldn't need traffic lights. You wouldn't need road striping. You wouldn't need, in fact, you probably wouldn't need roads as they're conventionally designed. What you have is more like a lattice of patterns, right? The vehicles would know where each other were. They could avoid each other, right? They could work together. If you took the humans out of the equation, it simplifies the problem incredibly. And now you've got an actual working solution. So you could even take it to a point of imagining a utopia where you built housing and be served by these autonomous vehicles that wouldn't need a lot of those home ownership, a lot of the ownership structures that we have right now. Most cars spend their time being parked. Very few of them are utilized 100% of the time. So the point of the opportunity inventory is to have these conversations where you say, well, what's ready? What's changed since the last time we did this review? Is there some new development that's made something possible that wasn't possible before? To have those very living conversations where people are routinely looking through what we're thinking as an organization might be attractive.
I was just laughing to myself. I was thinking, innovation efforts, many of them fail. Transformation efforts, 75%, people say, for example. And they mainly fail because of the human as well. It's the human resistance to the change. All the odds would go up so much if the human wasn't involved in the change. Speaking of this aspect of the human being involved, when you were saying, like, if you're going to go after an idea, make sure it's going to be a good one. And the next chapter in the book is building blockbuster products and services. And you tell us here, the simplest way to change a business model is to redesign your offerings, your products or services. What you should be aiming for is a blockbuster design, one that so appeals to your target audience that they feel almost compelled to buy from you. And identifying opportunities for redesign is what the next chapter is about. And this is where you introduce the idea of a simple mapping process that gives you a start on capturing how well your product or service is appealing to your customers' needs at the moment. This is one of the articles you wrote in HBO, or this is the idea of the attribute map.
Yeah, so you can think of an attribute map as identifying how well the capabilities of your company, on the one hand, sort of project onto the needs and desires and jobs to be done, I would call it today, of your customer on the other. And so what attribute mapping is, it's almost like a mirror between the two. And the way the technique works is you've got attributes, or you know, this is like product characteristics or service characteristics that are positive. People like them. You've got attributes that are negative. People don't like them. Or you've got attributes that for a particular segment, they just don't care about. So the first, I think, important concept is to recognize that customers do come in different flavors. And we all know this from Marketing 101. But the typical way that companies look at customers is not very productive. So the typical way companies look at customers is by what are called demographics. So how much money do they have? Where do they live? What is their postal code? What tier do they live in? How old are they? That kind of thing. And I'm not saying it's bad to know those things. What I'm saying is those things are knowable by anybody that can do the research. And they make the fundamental assumption that the way customers behave is consistent with those demographic attributes. And what we find is it often radically is not. I was working for a time at the Boots Corporation, and their head of marketing was desperately frustrated. He came into one meeting and said, "Us customers just don't behave in the stores the way they're supposed to." I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "I've got grannies in there with iPads checking on prices. They shouldn't be doing that." Yeah. I think sometimes as companies, we almost get offended when customers behave in a way that we didn't, that crosses our demographic assumptions. So the first key thing to think about is, what is the key behavior that you need to appeal to when you are thinking about what you're going to sell to someone? Who is that customer? And what is it that they most want from you? And how is that different from the behavior that other customers might exhibit? So I think that's the first big principle. And then for that behavioral segment, if you look at the positive features, they come in three flavors. So the first is what I call a non-negotiable. So it's a positive feature, but I won't even, if you don't offer it, I'm not even going to consider your offering. So just take something really simple like a hotel room, right? So what do I just flat out expect when I go into a hotel? Well, I expect a smooth check-in process. I expect the key to only open my door. I expect to be able to have a clean room. I expect a good bed. I expect the sheets to be clean. I expect the bathroom to function well. I expect the desk light to work. I expect to be able to access. I could go on all day naming the things that I simply expect when I go into a hotel room. And that's the problem with the non-negotiables. They're often very expensive. They're also very difficult to do. But they offer zero competitive differentiation, because just to be in the category at all, you've got to be able to offer those things. And next we have what we call the discriminators. These are differentiators, right? So I buy a BMW as opposed to a Mercedes because maybe I bought their thing about BMW being better for the driver and Mercedes being better for a family, whatever. But you're not wildly excited about the difference. They're established product categories. You know what the differences are and can plan accordingly. Now, to create a competitive advantage, you have to find what we call exciter features. These are things that a customer looks at and goes, "Whoa, that is amazing. I need that." If you give me a trip down memory lane opportunity in the book, we talk about the cup holder in cars. That's an example of this. So Honda, back in the day, would do this very interesting thing with their new car designs. They actually sent automotive engineers to participate in the sales process. And automotive engineers are not necessarily great salespeople. But what they would do is they would be on the ground and they would look at customers. They look at their unmet needs. They look at what things were working for them, what didn't work for them. And so they came over from Japan to America. And what they noticed was that Americans, being Americans, we eat and drink and do stuff all day long. And our cars are like a second living room. And so there's coffee and there's donuts and there's, you know, stuff in the car, and there's no place to put the coffee cup, right? So either you balance it somewhere or you put it between your knees, with sometimes very unfortunate consequences, or whatever, but there's no place to put it, right? And nobody was complaining about that, by the way. There was no thought that this was a necessary innovation. This was something these guys observed was a behavior that they wanted to hone in. And so they invented this cup holder. Now, the early cup holders, you may remember, very primitive, right? You folded the thing down, you put your coffee cup in it, it was a little plastic thing, not very evolved, right? But let's think about this. So we have a young couple, they're out buying a car, and their list of non-negotiables is as long as my arm. It's got to be good quality, it's got to get great gas mileage, it's got to be very durable, it's got to have a great repair record, blah, 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 blah. And so we look at the Toyota, right? And the Toyota is great. It ticks all those boxes, but let's just keep looking. So we get to the Nissan, right? And that's great. You know, it ticks all those boxes. And then we get to the Honda. Honey says one to the other, look at this. It has a cup holder. What a great idea. Let's buy the Honda. You know, this kind of consumer decision-making is the despair of automotive design engineers, right? And these guys want to think about torque and wind flow and energy efficiency and all that stuff. And what do customers want to buy? They want to buy the car with the cup holder because that gets a job done that is important to their daily life that nobody had solved elsewhere. Now, of course, that year, you could not buy a Honda in the United States that year. They had them backlogged. People were on waiting lists to get these Hondas. That's how popular this was. Now, part of the thing about Exciter features is everybody else, unless you got an entry barrier of some kind, everybody else is going to copy. So the next year, does Toyota have cup holders? You betcha. Does Nissan have cup holders? Absolutely. 2 years later, even Ford gets around to cup holders, right? So this illustrates a fundamental dynamic of this map, which is that things that start off as exciters, as customers come to demand them, they come to be differentiators. And then eventually they end up as non-negotiables. And by the time they have gotten there, you really want to be in a low cost position. Because sometimes with the heady days of having an exciter where people will pay basically anything to get it, you get sloppy, right? You get sloppy about operations, you hire too many people, you know, do stuff that doesn't allow you to be cost effective when the things become kind of a non-negotiable. So the negative line goes the other way. So if it's basic, which is the sort of basic stance, if it's negative, I'll tolerate it. I'll put up with it. And if you think about it, most products have vast numbers of things we put up with. We prefer to do without them, but right now we don't think of any legitimate competitor being able to help us escape, so we'll tolerate them. As companies work the negative line, they start to get rid of tolerables. So you may remember a few years ago, there was a big campaign by Apple to get people who were using Microsoft products to switch. And they said, we're making switching super easy. And if you come over to the Apple ecosystem, no more blue screen of death, No more bugs, no more quirkiness, no more. It's all a beautifully designed ecosystem. And a lot of people converted at that point. So once somebody's demonstrated that a tolerable can be avoided, now it becomes a dissatisfier. It gives your customers a reason not to buy from you. It dissatisfies. And if it goes on long enough, it becomes what we call an enrager, which means it's so bad, it's so dreadful. I'm going to turn my back on that product and never come back again. And so you lose your customers in droves when you get an enrager there. And the negative line kind of works in many ways opposite to the positive line. Things that are once tolerable become less and less tolerable. Eventually, people get dissatisfied with them. And eventually, they can end up as enragers. Basically, give up on that customer segment or get rid of that feature if it's an enrager for your customers. And then lastly, we have the neutral line, which just basically acknowledges that not everything is important to every customer segment that you might deal with. So back to my example of hotel rooms, when I travel, I almost never turn on the television in a hotel room. I just, for whatever reason, if I'm traveling, I'm usually super busy and it's just not what I spend time on. So you could, if you were catering to the customer segment of Rita, think of the cost you could save. You could take every television out of every hotel room in the world. But here's the problem. It's neutral for me, but it's not neutral for many other people. It's a non-negotiable for them. So you need to understand when a customer really cares and when they don't. And then sometimes you have this fascinating set of things I call parallel features, which are not the functionality of the offer itself, but something that happens in parallel with it. It goes along with it, even if it isn't the actual functionality of the specific product. So it allows you to add more value or create a better environment or do something that's more fun because it's offered in parallel with the main offer. So back in the day, our canonical example was compact discs. So I'm dating myself, right? Compact discs that were sold in Victoria's Secret stores. So you may remember Victoria's Secret, sexy women's lingerie, and you think to yourself, why would Victoria's Secret be one of the largest at the time, largest sellers of compact discs? Well, you're not in a Victoria's Secret store buying the sensible That's sensible. Non-sexy undergarments, you're there for a reason. And wouldn't it be nice to have music that went with that? So that's an example of a parallel offer. So what would happen would be you'd go into the store. Now, again, this is back in the day, back around the time the book was written. You'd go into the store. And the first thing you'd do is they'd give you this lovely black bag, right? And so you could discreetly put your purchases in there while you were shopping in the store. And then when you made your selections, you did whatever, and you got to the checkout, there'd be one compact disc. And it would be the disc that had been chosen, to accompany, ideally, the event that this underwear was being purchased to go with. And what was fascinating to me about it was they were very deliberate about it. It wasn't walls of CDs. It was one. And then you would be able to pick that one up. And they changed them monthly. So each month would be a different CD. And eventually they got to the stage you could order them online. And then, of course, everybody piled on. So you had Starbucks selling CDs and others. And then CDs away. And now we don't have that anymore. But back in the day, it was a very interesting example of a parallel.
Let's build on this, because you mentioned there about Honda. Eventually, your competitor is going to catch up with you. Then it becomes a non-negotiable for everybody. And you talk here about the importance to keep abreast of high-impact trends, for example, those likely to have the greatest impact on your business, even if they have a low probability of actually coming to pass. And here you say, also look at major competitive changes that could occur in your industry. A good framework to employ here is, as you mentioned earlier on, Porter's five forces. What are the major factors that could have an impact on buyer power, supplier power, potential substitution, potential entry and exit, and competitive rivalry? Maybe you'll share some ideas on this, keeping it abreast of trends.
This will show up again later in Seeing Around Corners. But if you think about any offering, it's created at a point in time when some things are possible and some things are not. And as you develop your success recipe, it reflects those realities. So the kinds of trends you want to look at are things that are going to shift those realities by a factor of 10. So something that allows you to operate 10 times faster, 10 times more cheaply, 10 times with 10 times less overhead. So to make that very concrete, if you look at men's shaving, and you think about Gillette, right, the dominant force in men's shaving, Procter & Gamble bought Gillette for $57 billion in 2005. And they'd been the dominant player in men's shaving forever, right? So very good business model. So they have a lot of R&D that allows them to create better products, that allows them to charge higher prices. And they got their armies of employees that send all these things into retail stores. And it's like a clockwork. It just turns and turns, generates enormous profits, massive market share. I think at their peak, they had some 70% global market share. And the entry barrier was all this advertising, all this protective R&D, all these patents that they had. And manufacturing razors is actually hard. It's not an easy thing to do. But if you look at the period of time through the O's, through the emergence of e-commerce, through the emergence of direct-to-consumer, what you could have seen where you paid attention was the vast drop in the expense of acquiring digital capability. So by the time you get to 2010, you've already got Amazon Web Services in place. You've got Microsoft Azure in place. You've got these cloud-based providers to build an e-commerce site. All that's already done. You can buy that off the shelf, right? So you don't need to hire expensive developers. Maybe you hire a designer to put a fancy front end on it. The hard program is already built for you. And so what's happened now is entering into a startup can be done at a fraction of the cost that it would take to recreate what Gillette had built. And so that's an example of the kind of big trend where you say to yourself, hey, wait a minute, I'm counting on the fact that I've got billions and millions tied up in factories and doing this intense manufacturing to protect me. But if now that's readily available off the shelf, that's no longer going to be the case.
And again, you warn against this later on about overinvesting or getting yourself stuck down with, say, for example, hard assets that you have a big factory, for example, or when you can rent, it's one of the easy ways to go forward.
There's an important exception to that, though, Aidan. So if you've got, and Apple would be an example people will be familiar with, but if you've got a vertically integrated opportunity to create something that is unique, then it actually makes sense to build it yourself. One of the big problems, and Gillette's a great example, right? So in 1990, they owned it all, right? They had the patents, they had the technology, they had the manufacturing know-how. Nobody else knew how to do that. But with globalization, with the entry of China into the WTO, which happened in 2001, what started to happen was all those capabilities began to be outsourced. Now, that sounds great in the short term. But what happens now is you're leaking your know-how. You're leaking your tech. You're teaching other people how to do this stuff that never used to do it before. in service of getting a slightly better price for what you're doing today. And I happen to think a lot of companies are now regretting that those decisions were made, because once the genie's out of the bottle, once you've trained your supplier how to do this stuff, all of a sudden they can become a potential rival.
We had Professor Yossi Sheffi on the show, and he did a three-part series on supply chains. And he was saying this, that, for example, if you had outsourced to China, they demand to see the IP, they demand to see how you're doing it. And for that very reason, so they can see inside the bottle and see what the genie looks like.
One of my clients is a pharmaceutical company, and I was talking to their head of Chinese markets. And she said, it's awful that what they do is they'll have this patented drug in the US, let's say a cancer drug. And they'll, in order to access the Chinese market, the government will say, yes, of course, that's great, come on in. And she'll have maybe a year and a half before the government has actually funded a firm to compete head to head with their patented drug with a locally grown biologic. And she knows she's got 18 months to make the money that they're making in China. Now, the trade-off is, it's a really big market. Do you want to go there at all? But then you're going to lose your IP. So how do you play that game? And she was very frustrated because her senior leadership doesn't seem to understand that, unlike other nations, that the patent is meaningless after a period of time once they've taught a local company.
That just absolutely exemplifies the point. So maybe to close this episode, part one, I wanted to introduce this idea you call quizzing, which I love this methodology. You say here, after we have filled the opportunity register with ideas based on redesigning the mix of attributes we have to offer customers in existing products and services, next, we need to find new opportunities for differentiation, meaning ways to set us apart from the competition and that customers perceive as positives. And this is the idea of quizzing, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah, so quizzing is just asking a series of questions that really try to get beneath the surface of what you might observe a customer doing. So here's a particular moment in consumption of this product. And you ask questions like, who's with them at that moment, right? Who else could be there? Is there someone who's not there that they would like to see? What are they trying to accomplish at that moment? Is there some way we can make it easier or more intuitive or less effortful? And so you just ask a whole series of questions that interrogate what the customer's experience is at a moment in time. So let me bring this to life a little bit. One of the companies we worked with back in the day was this candle company.
I love this. I was going to ask you. I absolutely love this story.
And so what is a candle? You could not think of a more commodity-like product, right? It's a lump of wax with a string in it that you light up. Candles have been around for thousands and thousands of years. So how on earth do you differentiate a candle? And so what we started to do is we started to look at, well, what occasions prompt the need for a candle? And so what ended up falling out was, well, actually, there's very specific reasons people would buy candles. So there's the first date, right? And you want, or the first date in your home or something where you want to make a nice impression. You might have a candle that's bespoke for that. There's a candle that maybe is just setting the mood. It's an air freshener or whatever. And you've got, maybe you have a breakup candle. You know, but we started to think about all these occasions for the use of candles. And what ended up happening was Yankee Candle was able to really use these of candle usage to create very differentiated products. And one of my favorite stories about this is actually my mother. My mother and at the time, my dad lived by themselves. So the kids had flown, so they were on their own. And they were German and frugal. And my mother would flip coupons and look at the prices of things. And she was very, very careful shopper and under normal circumstances, right? But then Thanksgiving, which is a big American holiday, is coming up and her kids are coming home. And the fact that we're coming home is fine, but her grandchildren are coming home, right? And so it's a completely different emotional experience. And normally she buzzes through the store and she doesn't even glance at the sort of place where they have like the fancy candles with all the stuff on them and the extra ones. So she passes by, happens to be a two. Now, by the way, you have to remember, in her shopping cart, which normally has a few necessary things for a couple of older people who like to cook at home, now it's full of things that she never in her life dreamed of buying, like Go-Gurts and chocolate cereal, stuff like that. And so she's already mentally spent $400 or $500 on the stuff that's in this cart. She sees the perfect candle for the centerpiece of the Thanksgiving table. Does she even think twice about putting it in the cart? Absolutely not. And again, now if you think about a candle, there is margin there. It costs nothing practically to make these things. And so to package them differently for the different needs that the different kinds of consumers have became the way that this particular company went to market, and it was very successful.
You tell us in the book, he bought it for a couple of hundred million, I think it was, and it became a $1 billion business pretty quickly, which just shows you the value of quizzing as well. So Reid, I think maybe we'll blow out the candle on this episode and then we'll go on to, is the game worth the candle, which is what we're going to cover next when we look at consumption change analysis and many more of the brilliant aspects that you talk in the book. But for now, we'll close part one on this brilliant book, The Entrepreneurial Mindset. And I'm very grateful for you joining us. Reid, before we close this episode, where can people find out more about your work, your fireside chats, Spark Hub, etc.?
Sure. So I have a website, which is called ReidaMcGrath.com. That's very imaginative, right? But on the website, you'll find a section called Thought Sparks, which is my regular articles that I write about things I just think are interesting and that, as the name suggests, are there to spark your thinking. There's also an events tab where you can click on it, and that will show you upcoming fireside chats. We've got some demonstrations coming up of the software. It'll show you things that are coming up in the future. And then my sister company, Valise, is the sort of companion to the Reid McGrath ideas, because what Valise exists to do is make this stuff implementable in your organization. So that's Valize. And if you go on that website, you'll be able to see demonstrations of the software. You'll be able to access learning guides. There's a lot of material there.
Fantastic. Reid McGrath, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.